Welcome, everybody. It is great to see you all again. We are live, whatever that means. I suppose that's what we're discussing writ large, always. I'm continuing with our study of the Zohar. Last time we were in a teaching about nighttime and depositing the soul at night. Get to the right spot. After we finish this teaching, we have two teachings left in the Hakdama. The teaching of Rabbi Shimon in the cave, and then just so you have a roadmap of where we're going. So we'll finish this. We'll do Rabbi Shimon in the cave. And then we'll get into if I'm remembering the order correctly, a list of 14 mitzvot that the Zohar feels are ordinarily more important than the others and need to come first and are alluded to in Bereishit. And 14 things you need to know before you can do the rest of the Zohar. And it'll just be kind of a long list of that. Okay, now you need to know these 14 things. It's weird to have like a very ordered list like that. But okay, so that's where we're going. Now, I think we were Ubit Safra Kam Mearse. So yes. We talked about at night, you deposit your soul, and we talked about some of the Lorianic understandings of what it means to deposit your soul, and how biyadchav kidruchi, that verse, in your hands I deposit my soul, could be an acronym for be'er, for well, and that you're creating a well where you deposit your soul. And we talked about different divine names that might be associated with that, and different things like that. We also referenced the code in the back of the mezuzah because we talked about the name Bochu for the name Ahiyah, and I failed to follow up and do any research on the cipher on the back of the Megillah. Rabbi Comfer, have you done any research on that?
No, but if you have a cloth and you turn it over, you'll see on the bottom, Kuzu B'muchsaz Kuzu. And it must relate to this same code of taking the letter before or after the letter
before.
The letter before, because it's Hashem, Elokeinu Hashem.
Yeah, so we'll, okay, so that's...
I didn't do any further research. It's a Rabbi Lehman code.
Okay, so at some point, maybe over Passover, someone can figure this out. Like why, I mean, we know what the code is, but why a code for that? Ubit Safra in the morning, Kamer say, Bai Levracha the Mariel Mail the Vese, Ula Miskad Kamehe Chale Bidachilu Sagya, Uvasar Kane Yitzlitzlo Sevi Yisev Eta Meinun Abahan Kadishan Dachsiv, Ani Rov Chasecha, Avovi Sacha, Eshachavel Hechal Kodcha, Yira Sacha. In the morning, upon arising from bed, so at night you deposit your soul to protect you from any grave illness or maleficent spirit, which are now powerless against you because, and you're kind of preempting, right? In other words, as we mentioned, your soul is going to kind of leave at night. It's a time where you're not in control. It's a time of anxiety and just like death. And so you can preempt that by kind of pre-depositing your soul with God as a form of protection. In the morning, when you've survived, I'm adding, upon arising from bed, one should bless his Lord. Now, notice this advice, you'll see, the person's getting up in the morning. You may recall prior teachings where we talked about what happens when a person gets up at midnight. So, query, is this a different instruction for the non-mystic who is not getting up at midnight? Or is it that you got up at midnight but went back to sleep? and are now getting up in the morning? Are these just different, you know, or do they assume you're not getting up at midnight every night? I'm just noting, you know, the different kind of streams here. The morning upon, or maybe it's for regular people. One should bless his Lord, enter his house, bow down in great awe before his sanctuary, and then offer his prayer. Now, they actually have an embodied ritual here. You go to shul almost immediately, and you bow down. Anyone ever seen anyone do this? Walk into the shul and bow? This was a mystical custom. Maybe it still is. Now, the verse that they say you should say here is still in the Siddur. It's printed in the Siddurim. And I believe the Matt footnote suggests that actually they were interpreting, there was already a Spanish custom to say this verse when entering the synagogue. And they were kind of attributing meaning to it. If we look in footnote, In the Zohar, this, did I get the wrong one?
562.
Yeah, here it refers to the Spanish custom of reciting this verse from Psalms upon entering the synagogue. See Abu Jarham, Shalom, etc. So it seems to be suggesting there was a custom to recite this verse. In any event, the custom spread once the Zohar endorsed this idea, and it's there. So, and then offer his prayer.
So is that how it is, Matovu? Isn't that the end of the way we have it as part of Matovu?
Right. So we have it as Matovu. And Matovu must serve as a near liturgical replacement for the idea of bowing down in great awe before his sanctuary. In other words, rather than bowing down in great awe, you could say, Matovu Oalecha Yaakov Mishkanotach Yisrael. Wow, look at these shuls. So wow, look at these shuls. Another way of saying bow down in great awe. It's just saying it. And then we do end with this verse, although I think people, even if people recite Matovu, I imagine many people leave out this verse.
Finding that verse in the page where I have Matovu in this Siddur.
It's not in the Koran?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's got
Yeah, that's it, isn't it?
That's it.
That's the verse.
I thought it was Biatcha of Kidruk Ruchi.
Oh, no. Right, that's at night. And in the morning, it's Vani Eshtachaveh. Yeah, so this is in all of our Siddurim now, even though it was a Spanish Rite liturgy, probably because of this Zohar endorsement of it, right? I don't think it's a Nusach Ashkenaz original. And what should you do? Should seek advice from those holy patriarchs, as it is written, as for me, through your abundant love, I will enter your house. I will bow down at your holy sanctuary in awe of you. So they have established, did I read this yet in Hebrew? I don't know if I read this. Let me go back. Hachi ukmu la b'bay le levarnash la'ala leve kenishta. So they have established, a person should not enter the synagogue without first consulting Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, for they innovated prayer to the Blessed Holy One. As it is written, as for me, through your abundant love, I will enter your house, Abraham. I will bow down at your holy sanctuary, Isaac, in awe of you, Yiratecha, Jacob. One should embrace them first, then enter the synagogue and offer one's prayer. So it is written, he said to me, you are my servant Israel, in whom I will be glorified. So what is happening here? Several things are happening here. At a very basic level, there is a time. Okay, so first thing first, we need to know the rabbinic tradition that the forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, instituted the prayers of Shacharit, Mincha, and Ma'ariv. There's a debate in the Talmud and Brachot about what are the where the prayers come from. Do they come from the sacrifices, the morning sacrifice, the Korban Tamid, the afternoon Korban Tamid, and then it burned all night, Ma'ariv? And therefore, Ma'ariv is kind of optional because it just burned all night. It wasn't a new sacrifice. Or were they instituted by Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? And the Gemara hedges. It kind of says, well, the forefathers instituted them, but they also correspond to the sacrifices. Both end, says the Gemara in this debate, if I'm recalling correctly. And so that's the first thing. We have this tradition. Now, the Zohar is dealing with a few questions. What is prayer? And like, how do we have the audacity to pray? Or how can we imperfect sinners come to pray? That kind of question. And the greater the grandeur and glory of God in this system, the harder it is. So in place of like a self-forgiveness, which a modern like psychologist might offer, like forgive yourself in order to be able to pray. The Zohar suggests consulting or gaining permission really is the right imlich. Not just consult, but like seek, it's like consent would be a better word. Something like what the Senate is supposed to do or something like that for the appointees. Maybe not give you too hard a time, but kind of approve or maybe not. I don't know. That's a political question. But consent, I think, is a slightly better translation. You should first get consent from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because they're the ones that started this whole thing, you know? So when you're going to do Shacharit, you should have consent from Abraham, who instituted the prayer. And Mincha is Isaac, and Ma'ariv is Jacob. And by doing this, we are connecting our prayers to a chain of prayer as part of a tikkun. So one of the ways we enter into prayer with God, this is a spiritual technique again, is by saying, look, I'm not coming to pray as me. I'm coming to pray and to join with the Shekhinah as part of the divine emanation. And I'm coming to connect with the energy of my ancestors that innovated this spiritual practice. And by doing that, we're kind of de-emphasizing individualism and ego in a way that already creates a more efficacious prayer, because it just that technique opens someone up to the possibility of, in fact, connecting with God. So there, by seeking consent to be able to pray, you are already kind of lessening the self, or what the Kabbalists will call bitul hayesh, yes? Lessening or canceling. So canceling the self sounds like some kind of political comment gone awry. Self-cancellation. No, but bitul hayesh is that. So an intentional tzimtzum or withdrawal of self in order to actually ultimately become something much bigger, to be able to enter into prayer. It is also connecting in time with all of the prayers of the past, so that you're not just praying Shacharit, you're praying Shacharit and adding Shacharit into the mixing bowl of all of the Shacharits that have ever been prayed before. That's part of what is going on. The classic commentaries, by the way, that's the line of thought that they are most interested in. That and the Sfirot, of course, we'll get to the Sfirot, but many of the classic commentaries on the Zohar, which I read, emphasize the kind of sense that we're moving towards a tikkun. So Shacharit isn't just a prayer for my day. Shacharit is a prayer, a mincha and ma'ariv, that the world move towards its ultimate perfection. And if we're trying to move the world towards its ultimate perfection, we need to understand the roadmap or the chronology of how prayer is efficacious in bringing about the divine presence and the tikkun gamur, the final revelation. And so you need to add it in. It's not just an isolated prayer. And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, of course, represent the sfirot of chesed. This is my final comment about this, I think. Chesed, gevura, and tiferet, of loving kindness, of strength, and of the balance between those two. And the prayer services, the three prayer services, can be seen as an effort to channel those. Shacharit is like starting the day with loving kindness because God has bestowed us life of loving kindness. Mincha is, you know, after a day. You know, after a day, it's been a day. It's more gevura. Rav Kook says it slightly differently when he briefly quotes the Gemara and I think this Zohar as well. That mincha happens in the middle of a work day. So it in and of itself is an act of like gevura to do it. Work and sustenance is a kind of gevura-like activity, a loving kindness activity. And Jacob is the balance between those poles, at least in the theology of it. And each Amidah is an effort at bringing down these three fundamental, right, like love, fear, and balance between the two. Love and fear and balance between the two. Those are the two fundamental motivations in this Zohar. You could love God, you could fear God, and you could balance them. Chesed, gevura, tiferet. Love, fear, and balance. So the whole prayer is seen as an effort at kind of bringing those down through Netzach, Yisod, etc., into fruition. But that's it. Chesed, gevura, and tiferet. That's what we're trying to do in the prayers, channel them. So of course you have to seek consent. And there are rabbis that actually do this, that ask permission. The Shla HaKadosh in his Sidur Shar HaShamayim wrote poems before each of the prayers in order to seek permission from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And those poems are actually called Shar HaShamayim, the gates to heaven. And they all reference Sha'arei Shemayim, the gates of heaven, in the refrains of the poems. He did a different one for each of the three prayers as they seek permission, which became the name of the Sidur. Sidur Shar HaShemayim, the gate to heaven. So, you know, some people started to write poems asking permission from Abraham. Or I once heard Brother Victor Nevensol, the chief rabbi of the Old City, before davening first Marav, first ask permission from Jacob. Out loud, he said, "We need to ask permission from Jacob to pray Marav." What? Jacob? Why are we asking permission from Jacob to pray Marav? Now I understand. It was a moment. He didn't explain. So, okay. Now, any comments at this moment? This really changes the whole. It's a way of framing prayer differently. Now there is some dispute, debate, textual issues with Isaac. If we go into the actual things, Abraham, I will enter your house. And I, in your abundant love, will enter your house. That is a good description of Abraham because Abraham was the paragon of loving kindness and he also entered the divine house. He chose to be a God worshiper. So that matches Abraham well. We understand Da Avraham, that's Abraham. What about Eshtachavel Hechel Kodshach? I will bow down at your holy sanctuary, Isaac. So I actually didn't think it's that hard, but Matt says, and a lot of the commentaries also are in this place, the correlation of the next part of the verse with Isaac is not clear. I thought it was clear. I thought it was talking about the Akedah. I will bow down at your holy sanctuary. I thought that was an obvious reference to the binding of Isaac, which is also known as the place of the temple and fits well with the idea of gevura, of kind of strength and restraint, restraining one's own impulse to do what they think in the face of a divine command, and Isaac restraining himself from whatever, and the angel restraining himself from not slaughtering. There's a lot of gevura in that thing, and it occurs. So I don't know why this is seen as complicated by the commentaries, but people don't want to say that. Did I lose you all? Have I lost you? I don't know if it froze. No. So
you've been glitchy a little bit, but I think it's working.
Okay. Yes, I'm not sure. Maybe someone can help me. Does that not seem like the obvious read that I will bow down at your holy sanctuary is referring? Isaac is just a clear reference to the
Isaac. Absolutely, it seems right. And remember, the name of God associated with Isaac is Pechad Yitzchak, right? So,
yeah, the fear of Isaac, and God uses his name Elohim, which is the name of Gevurah. There's in that whole story, Elohim Yireh. And I really don't understand why this is seen as complicated. All the commentaries seem to think it's complicated, and maybe we should amend the text, that it doesn't make any sense, and blah, 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 blah. Who am I? But I here it is. Okay, and then Jacob, Biyiratecha, because of Norah. Ma Norah Makom Hazeh, when Jacob finds God, surprisingly, when running away from his brother, and he goes to sleep, he says, you know, Hashem b'makom hazeh v'anochi lo yadati, this place is so amazing. Norah, related to Yirah or fear or awe. And the Zohar is going to get into with the first of its commandments. You know, wait, is Yirah fear or is Yirah or awe? Sorry. Is it awe or fear? What is it? The Zohar is going to flesh that out. Is it awe or fear? It's going to have a take, a very dogmatic. Did you freeze? Oh, no.
Oh, you did. Everyone else seems to be moving on my screen. So is it just the rabbi frozen?
Am I unfrozen?
You're unfrozen.
Well, for the phrase I'm frozen, you were unfrozen, but then you refroze.
Oh my goodness. Okay, I'm going to try and keep speaking and hopefully...
Okay.
This will work. So did we get Jacob? I lose Manura Makomase? And later, the Zohar, later, in the first of its 14 commandments you need to know before you can go any further, it's going to flesh out, is Yirah fear or is it awe? And it's going to have a really dogmatic, specific take on what Yirah ought to be and what it isn't. So if you're kind of wondering, what is this fear we talk about? Is it fear of punishment, or is it like awe at the immensity of God? But the common denominator between the two of them is they cause a kind of withdrawal or retraction, like who am I, or a smallness, a feeling of tininess, but they do it in totally different ways. So they're related, but they're different. So we'll get there. People always quote the ideas about this in the name, in the name of later sages, but the Zohar is very explicit about it. Okay. Cool. Finally, let's just go with the quote at the end. So it is written, he said to me in Isaiah, you are my servant Israel, in whom I will be glorified. So what's that about? So the mat note is helpful. Through contemplative prayer, the Jew, Israel, unites the triad of Sfirot, imitating Tiferet, who synthesizes Chesed and Gvura. So the idea here is that the prayer isn't just the prayer. Again, as we mentioned, the prayer is a synthesis, and therefore, Becha et Pa'ar, which is kind of like Tiferet, as it were, Tiferet being a stand-in for the whole enterprise, and I will be glorified. That is to say, I will become manifest through the embodied prayer when you bring down the divine flow. I'd say the only thing the Lurianic commentaries add a lot is placing this in the context of tikkun over time, not just bringing God down, but prayer being the mechanism or a mechanism for bringing the redemption of the world. So they put it in that vein. Ad kan, until now, we have been doing this teaching. And I believe It is time to move to the next teaching. Lema Amar Yitzias Rashbi Me'am Me'ara. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai leaves the cave. A famous Talmudic account on its own. It's probably worth it for people to refamiliarize themselves with that account, but it's somewhat lengthy, so I don't think we're going to do that now. I wasn't planning on, unless there's objection. We'll just do the Zohar's take on it. Basic backstory. Rabbi Shimon and his son Elazar are fleeing the Romans from the Romans because they are encouraging revolt against the Romans in the camp of Rabbi Akiva and crew. And they run away and hide in a cave. For how long?
You're a bit glitchy again, Rabbi Dollinger. I don't know if you might want to shut your camera off. Maybe that'll help with the bandwidth.
Let me check what's going on with the internet. See if there's a different...
Someone told me you also have to make sure that the microphone is on same as system and not on speaker headphones. Although you're wearing headphones.
Okay, let's try it now. I've switched to a phone hotspot from my cell phone instead of the router I'm using, which should be weaker, but let's see.
You're stronger so far. It's pretty smooth now, so.
Yeah, that could be beginner's luck. Okay, so how long was Rabbi Shimon in the cave for? Do people get Rabbi Shimon and his son revolt against Romans, run away, hide in cave?
Fiery eyes, all that stuff.
Yeah, try to come out of the cave, burn the people, fire, judgment, doom, and brimstone back into the cave and back out. I think it was a 14-year experience, right? Is that right? 2 7-year periods. Okay. Rabbi Pinchas Habashchir Kameh de Rabbi Rechumai Bekeif Yamad Deginosar Uvarnash Rav Ukeshisha Diyomen Hava Beinoi Istalaku Milachem Milmech Mei. Amar the Rabbi Pinchas Vadai Shmana Diochaich Chavrana Isle Margalis Even Tava. This Dakli's been a horadehi margalis, navka kinehirin de shimsha, minartika vinara kolama, bahu nahora kai mishmaelara vinayar kolama adiyasiv ati yomin, biyasiv akorsayed kitakayos, bahu nahora kalakola bevesach, uminahora diskalio bevesach, nafak nehirudakik uze air vinafik levar vinayar kal alma, zaka. Poke Bri, poke Zila Basre, Dahi Margalis, deny your alma, Dahashaisa Kaimalach. Rabbi Pinchas used to frequent Rabbi Rechumai by the shores of Lake Gennosar. Lake Gennosar was known for its magical healing properties and very sweet fruit. He was distinguished, and we're talking about in the Galil region near the Kinneret. He was distinguished, advanced in years, and his eyes had transcended seeing. Okay, one note here, and this is important for the story. Maybe I'll read it first. He said to Rabbi Pinchas, sorry, truly I have heard that our companion Yochai, that's Shimon bar Yochai, has a pearl, a precious stone. I gazed at the light of that pearl, issuing like the radiance of the sun from its sheath, illuminating the entire world. That light extends from heaven to earth, illuminating the entire world until Atik Yomin, the Ancient of Days, comes and sits fittingly upon the throne. That light is contained totally in your house, and from the light contained in your house emanates a fine thread-like ray, radiating, illumining the entire world. Happy is your share. Go, my son, go out after that pearl, illuminating the world, for the time is ripe. So, first, some relational pieces. Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair is known for a beraita, that a non-Mishnaic teaching about the order of what causes prophecy. And that teaching becomes the basis for the classic work by the Italian Kabbalist Ramchal, Misilat Yesharim. Misilat Yesharim is that book, is based on the Baraita of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair about, you know, cleanliness leads to godliness or whatever, etc., all the way up to prophecy. So it's an ordered kind of list. And Ramchal, who's a Kabbalist, takes it and makes a non-Kabbalistic work that is really a Kabbalistic illusion, or full of Kabbalistic illusions about the kind of ladder. In real life, or in the Talmud, Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair is the son-in-law, let me get this right here, son-in-law of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. But as often happens in the Zohar, the relationships flip, and here he becomes the father-in-law. This happens a lot. And people write essays trying to explain whether it's the genre, fan fiction, the Zohar just being playful and acknowledging its own kind of license by changing certain details, or whether that's a form of elevating him in importance by putting him back an earlier generation, or whether they're just confused by the word Chotein and Chatan, as Matt suggests in his footnote. I really have nothing further to say about why the Zohar occasionally changes family relations by moving people a few generations prior in the same family line, but it happens. It happens a lot. This is not the first time we've come across it either. Okay, so we used to frequently visit Rabbi Rehumai, and he's old, and his eyes had transcended seeing. Now, it's an interesting way of describing someone as so old they can't see anymore. His eyes are transcended seeing. It implies that now that he isn't distracted by the sights of the physical world, he can really see. In other words, seeing is actually the opposite of seeing in some sense, because seeing is distraction. And blindness might actually really be clarity and vision. Okay, this is the Zohar. You know, as a, just a, Melila Eschner, the professor, says that the Zohar frequently engages in kind of theme and tone like this by making things like, by declaring things to be the opposite of what they appear to be. It's a way of creating the mystical lore-like feel to the text. And she thinks the authors were very conscious of trying to create a kind of certain ethos. All right, she said to Rabbi Pinchas, truly I have heard that our companion Yochai is a pearl, a precious stone, right? And so this pearl, what is this pearl? It's the light from creation of Keter, Atik Yomin is Keter, Ancient of Days. It's the light from before. It's the primordial light, light before there was any division. It's light before there was any Tzimtzum, if you're a Laurianic Kabbalist. It's the earliest light. But that light, of course, got hidden away. We couldn't handle the light. We weren't ready for the light. The redemption isn't here. So in an almost Tolkien-like move, the light is hidden away in a pearl that is safeguarded by mystics throughout the generations who guard the light until the final redemption. Now, of course, Rabbi Shimon is the light, right? But there's also a pearl that contains that light. Here, Rabbi Shimon again assumes a role that we saw when they declared him greater than Moshe earlier, of kind of quasi or not quasi divinity, right? He is the hidden, Rabbi Shimon is the earthly representation of God's most pure, undifferentiated, hidden light. the Zohar, in other words, since the Zohar is Rabbi Shimon's work, this work named for its very radiance, is actually access to the light hidden away for tzaddikim that supposedly doesn't exist in the world. Of course, the hiding of light away mirrors, in this narrative, Rabbi Shimon hiding in the cave, right? The light is hidden and Rabbi Shimon hides. So this is a multi-layered allegory, a Zohar classic. They love to do this, to layer the symbols with meaning. And why? Why is the light hidden away? Well, we know the Romans, the evil forces are in control, as we've learned, right, during this time. God is absent, and some of it is demonic, and demonic here is embodied by the Romans who have forced Rabbi Shimon to hide. Have you frozen? No. Okay. People just froze, but there wasn't actually freezing. It was just stillness. So just to be clear, like the pearl is hidden for Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Shimon is hidden from the Romans. But so long as the world exists, or so long as Rabbi Shimon exists, or so long as the Zohar exists, we're not doomed to destruction, right? The world can still sustain itself because that animating light from Keter, from the crown, the earliest sphera, still is present. It's just hidden away in a really small pearl. In other words, emanation, that earliest light, is present even in our earthly world of oppression and war and violence from the Romans, or whatever you want to make the modern metaphor of that. There's ample choices in 2022. Choose, take your pick, whatever metaphor you like. But the idea is that even in that world, somewhere in a cave or in this book, the secret light sustains the whole world. The whole world is sustained because of the study of the Zohar, says the Zohar. And that light is contained totally in your house. So it's absent. It's totally absent except for in this place. Why don't we see it elsewhere? Why is this mystical tradition suddenly invented here in the Zohar and not present anywhere else? No, no. The light needs to be totally hidden away in order to protect it, because it's a dangerous world. The mystical tradition needed to be secured. And from the light contained in your house emanates a fine thread-like ray, radiating the illuminating. There's a really fine ray of light that goes out from this and causes the whole world to have whatever light it does. The world is the moon and this is the sun. Happy is your share. Go, my son, go out after that pearl, illuminating the world, for the time is right.
Let me interrupt if that's okay. We're getting a little bit of a contradictory tension. On the one hand, the light is hidden away, but on the other hand, it's illuminating the whole world. So is that reconciled by saying for a long time the light was hidden away, but now that we have the Zohar, we're illuminating the whole world? But of course, the light is restricted to the Zohar and those who study the Zohar, so it's hard to say that that light is illuminating the whole world. So where are we in those metaphors?
Yeah.
Isn't that also the fundamental tension with Hashem in this too? I think, like, in the idea of Zimzum, like, it's a retraction, but Hashem is everywhere.
And we must go back to the Sphero chart to help us out. Okay. We have no choice. Wasn't going to bring it out, but here we are. So Keter, here's the light. Yes. The light of Atik Yomin, of Ancient of Days. And that light of Keter is considered inaccessible. And we've even said that Bina is kind of the limit of human access, or Chochma, to the extent that we can try and have a little access to Bina, but not full access to Bina. This is kind of our limit. So this is totally hidden, right? That's the sense. The primordial light is totally hidden away. But if not for this light that is hidden, the world would not exist, because it is the first light. So even though it is totally hidden, it isn't totally hidden. That is to say, it appears to be totally hidden. But that's just because it's a total secret. It's like dark matter. You can't see it. But most of the material of the world, of the universe, may be dark matter, or they may just be wrong about the whole theory of everything. Because whenever your whole theory relies on something you can't observe, you know, that feels to me like whatever. I'm not a physicist, but like just an outside layperson, you know, it's like, well, this geocentric model has so many gaps and things that make no sense. Why, let's make the million curlicues to make it make sense. Whenever you're doing that, you kind of have to wonder if there's not something more fundamentally wrong. But okay, enough of me, the non-theoretical physicist. So Kepler is there. I don't know if this answers your question at all, Andy, but it's totally hidden too. But if not for its existence, there would be nothing else. So, yeah.
That's actually very nice. The one thing it doesn't fit with is the specific metaphor of the light illuminating the world. A hidden light doesn't illuminate, right? Like illumination sounds like it's not hidden, but your resolution is really perfect. It's everywhere, yet it's not visible. And so it's both hidden and everywhere at the same time. That works.
Well, that's why they have it be like one single thin ray. So like, in other words, I think what they mean there is to say that the smallest amount of illumination possible exists, like right. Infinitely, whatever the infinity, is there like an infinity of close to, whatever's the closest approximation of zero that isn't zero? Is there such a number? Right. So I feel like it needs a proper noun. Like infinity isn't infinite, it's infinity. So it's infinitesimally. Anyway, so I feel like that's what they're saying. The smallest, and they're making a comment in time. Now that Rabbi Shimon is coming out of the cave, the Zohar is being revealed. That's the analog. And you, Rabbi Rechumai, who has transcended seeing, who, in other words, can now, has studied all of the Torah and is old and is no longer distracted by physicality, no longer prone to error, you can go find that pearl. We're all Rabbi Rechumai. We're studying the Zohar. To go find it. We can find that hidden light. So now is the time. And the Zohar may be making a comment about time periods. Now is the time of redemption. The tikkun is beginning, which is why the Zohar will be revealed now. Rabbi Shimon coming out of the cave means the beginning of the time of rectification. So it definitely has a messianic overtone to it. Yeah. And of course, that's the tzaddik, you know, if we're like starting up there and going down, right? The righteous, there's like a direct flow from Keter through the absolute righteous person, the tzaddik or yesod, the foundation. So if you just see it. Yeah. Happy is your share. Go, my son, after the pearl illuminating the world, for the time is ripe. It also has a little resonance with a verse we quoted early on, Eit hazamir higi el yartzeinu, the time of the pruning has come. The Zohar opens with that, kind of the spring is around as a metaphor for the beginning of the Messianic era. And we discussed that in the beginning passage about the kos shel bracha, the blessing cup. The Zohar very much views itself as the beginning of a Messianic spring of sorts. Okay. So I'll go back to the Hebrew now. Nafik mikame v'kaim lamel v'hi arba utrein guvrin bahade. Chama train ziporin zahavu asen v'tamin al yama ramalon kala v'amar ziporin da'atun tasin al yama chametun duch devar yochai taman Ishtai porsa amar, Siporin, zilu vasipuli, parchu vazilu, alubiyama vazle lahon, adenafa ka inun Siporin, asianu vipumu de chadaminayu, piska chaduksiv, begava, tahaba yochai nafik min marta, Rabbi Elazar Bray, asalukabeba askachle mishanya vegufe malia chaludin. Bachabadeva amar vai de chamisich, the kach amar. Zaka chuki de chamis li bekach. Di umale la chamisa li bekach. Lo haveni bekach. He left him and was about to board a boat along with two other men when he saw two birds come flying over the lake. He shouted to them, "Birds, birds flying over the lake. Have you seen the sight of the son of Yochai, Bar Yochai?" He's trying to find them, he asked the birds. He paused a while and then said, "Birds, birds, go and bring me a reply." They flew off. They embarked, setting off across the lake. Before he had disembarked, those birds returned, and in the mouth of one of them was a note on which it was written, "The son of Yochai has emerged from the cave along with the son of Rabbi Elazar." Of course. He went to him and found him transfigured, his body full of moldy sores, because according to the tradition, in order to learn Torah not in the nude, he buried himself in the sand or the dirt so that he wouldn't be naked to be able to pray and learn it, and spent 14 years buried in the dirt of a cave. So he had these moldy sores. He wept together with him and said, "Alas that I see you so," like oi, alas, I don't know, vai, oi. "Oi that I see you so." Oi is a better translation than alas in my book. He replied, "Happy is my share that you see me so, for had you not seen me so, I would not be so," says the ever cryptic Rabbi Shimon. So what has happened here? There aren't a lot of commentaries explaining the symbolism of the birds, of the boat, all the commentaries, all the classics, all the monochrome. No one talks about it. I think there is a kind of Noah's Ark theme that is being riffed off of here with two birds and a boat and saving the world, kind of hiding away. Not a parallel, but just borrowing kind of associatively from that notion of birds above that can see what humans can't see because of their higher perspective. And so by going to the birds, these kind of who are in the Torah, these sources of like Noah is trying to save humanity as a beacon of righteousness from a world that's worthy of destruction, just like Rabbi Shimon. And Noah uses birds in order to find the dry land. And here in the inverse, people use the birds to try and find the tzaddik, the righteous person. So it's just kind of I think it's a narrative riff off of the story, but no one says that. And it warned earlier, saying new things about the Zohar could result in eternal damnation. So I just offer it as a possibility. Take it, leave it. That's what came to my mind in reading this. Most of the commentaries are confused about the symbolism. Okay, so you see what happens here. It's the only thing I'll add, and maybe we'll conclude here, is that there's a twofold. What's this ending where it's like he finds him, and when he finds him, so he finds him, but he's really beaten up from his experience. It's like horrible. It causes him to cry. So two things. And then he says, well, no, it's good. Happy is my share that you see. Had you not seen me, so I would not be so. On the one hand, with the teaching of Chizkiyahu, turning to the wall, this builds upon that motif, that suffering or turning towards suffering is actually necessary for the understanding or identification with Shekhinah, which is the gateway into the divine enterprise. The Shekhinah suffers in this world. And this is also a comment about time, which is to say that, like, would God not emanate in such a way as to remove God's presence to create demons and suffering and all of the stuff that causes Rabbi Shimon to have to hide away? Like, we wouldn't have a world. This is a statement of the Tzimtzum, as it were. We would just be overwhelmed by divine goodness. And this world is fundamentally beautiful, or the task here of redemption, which is tantalizing, of finding meaning in an apparently godless world full of evil. You know, like, if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have anything, says Rabbi Shimon. In other words, that's the system of this world. That's the paradox, you know? It's the paradox of the Tzimtzum, that God needs to, so to speak, withdraw from the world in order to be able to leave room for us to experience anything of it. And so that's what Rabbi Shimon is saying. Happy is my share that you see me so. Had you not seen me so, I would not be so. This is how God manifests in the world, says Rabbi Shimon. God manifests as a suffering servant. Sounding like my best Christian pastor today, but it definitely has that theological sense to it. That's the way it's got to be in this world, because that's what it means to be in this world. And so I'm glad you see me like this, because if you didn't see me like this, you would never see me at all. So that's the end of their take, the Zohar's take of Rabbi Shimon in the cave. People are more familiar with the Talmudic take about their arrogance when they come out and burn people who are not sufficiently religious and are sent back into the cave by God. But the mystical understanding of the cave is even a whole different one about that. So that...
Does anybody say who the two people are?
Who are the two people?
Two other men on the boat.
Yeah.
There's two other men on the boat.
There's just these pregnant kind of metaphors here with the birds you already went into, which is interesting, but the two people are also puzzling.
Yeah, you know, I could see, you know, making an argument for like the birds are Chochmah and Binah fluttering above, and the people are Chesed, Gevurah, and Tiferet, and Rabbi Rechumai is Tiferet here or something like that. You can make like a spheriotic argument maybe for that narrative in the story, but it feels forced to me. But if I had to like say who they were, that's who I would make them. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, you know, because that's the teaching right prior. And I assume there's a reason they put this teaching here. But also, you get the sense that they're now running out of teachings they feel need to be in the introduction, because the next one is the last one. And Rabbi Shimon in the cave feels like, okay, if we're going to learn about Rabbi Shimon, everyone knows that Rabbi Shimon in the cave. So before we start the Zohar, can you tell us what's the mystical meaning of Rabbi Shimon's experience in the cave? That feels a crucial introductory material. And now the last thing, the commandments of the Torah. There are 14 generic or general commandments. You need to know what we think they mean. And then, so we'll do that. And then we'll be done with the Hakdama, and we'll start Parsha Breshit, the formal commentary on the Parsha. And for a while, for the rest of the Torah, we'll be doing the Zohar on the Torah, and then we'll get to the Idra Rabbah and some of the great Zohar texts after we finish the whole Torah. But so there we are. So we'll, next time we'll start the 14. Next week, do you folks want to have class? I know it's right before Passover. I'm game, but I don't know if people are too busy.
I actually can't make it next week, so.
I'm on the fence.
I think I'm around.
I could come.
All right, yeah. I'll email. Do people want to have class on Passover itself? I think that would be nice, but.
That would work for me.
Yeah, that sounds great.
I'm not sure.
Guys, quick practical question. Were those of us who are using Sfaria, it looks like it runs out of rope on the translation. Is Matt what we should go to?
Matt is the translation. There is no better translation than Matt, even if they translated it oi as alas, which... I don't mean to tease. It's an incredible work. That they translated the Zohar into an inspiring, readable English. And it captures the magic of Zohar in the translation. You know, people have said they could read the Mat and get the same buzz or whatever as reading the Aramaic. So I think that's probably true. The Mat does capture the magic. The Mat is phenomenal, and the footnotes are truly remarkable in their exhaustiveness. So, yes. You can't go wrong with the
community. The community translation ends at this point with the Zohar online. So,
unless we want to make our own translation as a class as we go along, translated for Sfaria.
I'm happy to cheer you on.
Great. Okay, so thank you everyone for another edition. It's as always been a pleasure. Remember, before you pray, consent from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.